This news story was written by Teo Armas. A fallen bridge, a grieving son, and a return to a familiar field. Miguel Luna was on the key bridge when it collapsed. During an agonizing wait for his body, his family and friends honored the lifelong soccer player in the only way that felt right. Baltimore. Marvin Luna fished into his bag and eyed the cleats he had brought, just in case. The 28-year-old had not been planning to play soccer. His knee had been acting up again, and he had agreed to work in his family's food truck, parked near this patch of green synthetic turf. But as former teammates patted him on the shoulder on their way to the field, that field, it was hard not to think of his father. This was where Miguel Luna, once a semi-pro soccer player back in El Salvador, had spent so many weekends coaching his son and cheering from the sidelines. It was where the two had trained and competed with a team of men from their hometown. Now, on this overcast Sunday, it was the site of a soccer tournament to honor his dad's memory. Nearly a month had passed since a massive container ship struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing it to collapse while a construction crew was repairing potholes on the span overnight. Six of the workers, including Miguel Luna, a 49-year-old father of three, fell to their deaths into the river below. Authorities vowed to search through the massive pieces of concrete and mangled steel for their bodies. On Wednesday, crews recovered a red truck from the water and found Miguel Luna inside. But on the day of the tournament, his body had not yet been located. Only four men had been pulled from the water. Their loved ones were able to hold memorial services and funerals. In some cases, they had started the repatriation process to Central America. Miguel's family, though, was stuck in an agonizing wait. So the web of people who surrounded Marvin, primos and tios and friends so close they might as well be relatives, did the only thing it seemed they could. They borrowed blue turquoise uniforms, collected a stack of $1.20 bills in an envelope, and played soccer. State lawmakers passed legislation to provide financial help to the workers' families, and nonprofits raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for them. This day-long tournament was different. More than anything, this is an act of love, Juan Juarez, who had traveled from Pittsburgh to play goalie, said in Spanish. The tournament aimed to raise money for the family, he said, but to me, it's more about saying, we're here. Like Juarez, most of the players on the team, once known as FC California, named after their tiny rural hometown, had all immigrated decades ago with Miguel to the Maryland suburbs, where they worked in construction or welding jobs, and spent practically every weekend on the soccer field. It had been years since some of them had played together. They had wedding rings, knee braces, and bald spots now, but they easily fell into familiar routines. As they stretched, they called one another by their nicknames, Cadejo, Moro, Comegen. Marvin watched from afar until the referee blew the whistle to start the first match. He then sprinted over to the sidelines, threw on a jersey, and laced up his sea blue cleats. His dad, he thought, would have wanted him to join. Soccer brought them together as boys and men. To hear Juarez tell it, there were really only two things to do growing up in California: a coffee-growing community of a few thousand people nestled on the side of a volcano, help on the farm, or play soccer. Any other sport would have required equipment that was far too expensive. But to play football, all you needed was a group of kids, a ball, and a patch of dirt. Many who grew up in California back then agreed that Miguel Luna was one of the best, the kind of player who could play defense as well as he could attack. Other boys called him Chompipe, or Turkey, after the birds his family raised and the whistles he was known to let out on the field. It was no surprise, then, that after a stint in the Salvadoran military, he went on to play for a third-tier professional team in a bigger city nearby. But gangs were rife in this part of the Usulutan department, one of the hottest, poorest regions of the Central American nation, and opportunity was non-existent. So around 2001, a stream of young men left California one by one, and eventually landed in Glen Burnie, a working-class suburb south of Baltimore. Juarez and Luna were among five young men who split a two-bedroom apartment in a complex tucked near the highway. They worked 10-hour shifts as welders, pooling their wages to pay for rides to work and saving up the rest to send to relatives back home. Sundays, though, were for soccer, most often at the turf field in Baltimore's Brooklyn neighborhood, where they would face off against teams of other Central Americans. Their squad's official name changed, but the players stayed mostly the same. Miguel had left El Salvador when Marvin was still a child, and when Marvin followed his father to the United States more than a decade later, soccer immediately bonded them back together. Marvin, who had grown into a speedy teenage striker, jumped right in with adults twice his age. At one point, father and son worked together, including in construction at Bronner Builders, the same company that employed the 6 workers on the bridge. But it was their time on the field and the sidelines that made him feel closest to his dad. Following the coronavirus pandemic, FC California never got back together. Players had kids or moved away. Marvin injured his knee, and Miguel was starting to focus more on helping his wife, Carmen, sell pupusas and tacos dorados out of her pink and white food truck. In early March, he told friends, he was starting to think about quitting construction entirely to focus on that family business. A family left waiting. A few yards away from the soccer field on that Sunday, Carmen worked the cash register at the truck as a band of family members and friends buzzed around a tent set up in front. Grilling carne asada, flipping pupusas on the griddle, doling out plastic containers to the line of people. It was a routine they had perfected over the past few years, when they would volunteer to sell food to help raise money anytime someone in the Salvadoran community got sick or injured, or lost a family member. This time, though, they were doing it for themselves. Weeks had passed since they got that horrible phone call in the middle of the night, letting them know the bridge was gone. Each day was filled with another update. President Biden came to view the wreckage. Federal authorities launched an investigation. A channel to the port reopened. But even as politicians vowed to find the workers' bodies, the news the family so desperately wanted never came. Miguel Luna remained somewhere in the river. "My heart is broken," Carmen said in Spanish. "My wish is for them to find him, to be able to say goodbye and mourn him." Miguel's sister, Armida, received a humanitarian visa and flew in from El Salvador. The first time she got to see up close the life he had built in the United States and meet the grandkids he told her about in daily phone calls. "It's all so beautiful," she said in Spanish, breaking down into tears. "Just that he's no longer in it." The family at one point went to visit a memorial that had been erected on one side of the collapsed bridge, with crosses and flags laid out in a semicircle for each of the fallen construction workers. Maynor Suazo Sandoval, 38, from Honduras. Dorlian Roniel Castillo Cabrera, 26, and Jose Lopez, 35, from Guatemala. Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, 35, and Carlos Daniel Hernandez, 24, from Mexico. On the end was a Salvadoran flag for Miguel. On top, the family hung a brown Carhartt backpack, a framed photo of him and his wife, and a pair of boots he had left at home before his last time heading to work. "The men were immigrants who died doing their job," Juarez said. Authorities said every effort was being made to recover all their bodies, but as the wait dragged on, he couldn't help but think of the search for a missing submersible in the North Atlantic last year. How is it possible that you spend millions of dollars to search the entire ocean, but they're in a river, and they still haven't found them? He asked. By the time they made it out to the soccer field, some on his teammates feared they might never recover Miguel's body. A movie ending. The tournament got underway, occasionally broadcast live on Facebook. FC California won one game, then another, even as they swapped in and out players who had not stepped onto the pitch in years. It was single elimination, with 8 teams playing back-to-back as the crowd ebbed and flowed, and a vendor sold Elotes Locos and Mango to spectators. There weren't enough jerseys to go around for everyone from California who had come to play, so they traded them on the sidelines in between matches. In the final round, FC California faced off against Marathon Copan, a mostly Honduran team in dark blue jerseys that lobbed an early goal past Juarez. But Marvin Luna and his teammates tied the score just after halftime, and the scene that followed was nothing short of a movie ending. Marvin got the ball near center field and made a run toward the goal, maneuvering past one defender and then another. He sprinted with the ball toward the net, and then, with a powerful kick to the right, he scored, setting the team up for what eventually proved to be a decisive 3-1 victory. It was a bittersweet win. After the ref's final whistle, Marvin and his teammates huddled and knelt by the goal as Juarez led them in prayer. "The reason we're here today, it's not anything we would have wanted," he told the group. "And though we're here to show support, it's never going to ease the pain." As the circle broke, Marvin knelt to pose for a photo on the field that meant so much to his father. He grabbed a gold plastic trophy in the shape of a soccer cleat in one hand and held his 18-month-old son in the other.